This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
The BFM Breakfast Grill, connecting you to the top people and ideas. Presented by U Mobile.
Good morning. You're now listening to The Breakfast Grill. I'm Roshan Kunnison. As Euro 2020 kicks off tonight, or more accurately, early tomorrow morning, today on The Breakfast Grill, we're taking a deep dive into the state of the most watched football league in the world, the English Premier League. The EPL is the most valuable league in Europe, accounting for 8 out of KPMG's top 32 clubs in Europe, while making up 39% of total aggregate value of the list. On top of that, 5 of the top 10 are from the EPL. So today I'll be exploring the rise and fall of the European Super League and the Americanization of football with Kieran Maguire, football financial analyst, author of The Price of Football and professor of football financial analysis at the University of Liverpool. Kieran, welcome to The Breakfast Grill.
Thanks very much for the invite.
Kieran, let's kick this off with money. Since the 2000s, money and football have become increasingly synonymous, particularly with the influx of foreign money and ownership into the English Premier League when Roman Abramovich and Thaksin Shinawatra bought Chelsea and Manchester City. Since then, other clubs like Leicester, Cardiff and QPR have been taken over. From your view, Kieran, how has foreign ownership changed the landscape of English and European football?
What has happened as a result of foreign ownership is that we've introduced differing business models. We have some owners, such as Abramovich, such as Mansour, such as what we're seeing at Leicester City, where the objectives of the owners is that they want the glamour of being associated with the football club, and also they're prepared to invest in talent in order to win trophies. And clearly, from a fan's point of view, that's absolutely wonderful. On the other hand, we've got more of the American-style models, where we've got Manchester United, Liverpool, Arsenal being owned by American owners, and their focus has been more on the bottom line, that those clubs tend to be more profitable. And therefore, it's created a very intriguing meeting of minds, where you've got these different owner objectives, these different cultures of the owners coming in, and it has helped to make the Premier League more appealing because it's made it more unpredictable.
So outside of the big clubs, we're also seeing smaller clubs being bought up as well. And this is shown by Ryan Reynolds' takeover of Welsh club Wrexham. So in your view, what's the rationale essentially behind these kinds of purchases and investments? Do these things pay off over time, especially if we take a look at the financial impact from the pandemic?
Well, in the short term, I would never advise somebody to buy a football club, because the operational losses tend to be quite significant. However, If by buying a club, investing in the team, and then getting the benefit of promotion to the Premier League, all of a sudden you own an asset which is one of the 20 most watched on the planet from a sporting perspective. And that has a multiplier effect as far as the club's value is concerned, and you can sell it at a higher price. So provided you're prepared for some potentially hard times, then on a long-term basis, yes, you can make money. And you mentioned Cardiff City earlier. The owner there, Vincent Tan, he has put a lot of money into the club. It has been promoted. It's now been relegated again. But he seems very committed to the club. We see that with quite a few owners who perhaps initially did get involved with football, where perhaps they were looking for an exit route, but they fell in love with the club. They fell in love with the excitement and the kudos and the credibility that it brings to own a football club in what is the most watched team sport on the planet.
There seems to be an interesting parallel to F1 teams as well, right? Essentially, a lot of billionaires get involved there because there's a little bit of glitz and glamour to it all. But it's very rare that F1 teams make any money, if at all. When we take a look at the foreign ownership landscape, though, Kieran, there's been some pushback, some criticism over the amount of ownership there is. Is there an argument to be had for restricting foreign ownership?
I don't think so. Foreign owners can bring in new ideas. They can bring in fresh wealth, fresh investment to the game. And they have changed the landscape of the Premier League. Prior to Roman Abramovich, what we had seen in effect was that the Premier League was dominated by two clubs, Manchester United and Arsenal, and one of those two clubs used to win the Premier League every year. And frankly, it became a bit boring. So then Abramovich came to the party. Chelsea started to win trophies. Mansour came to the party in 2008-09, and Manchester City started to win trophies. And we've had the American investment in Liverpool, and Liverpool have won the Champions League and the Premier League and the World Club, the FIFA World Cup for clubs. So I think that's actually to be welcomed. And it's also helped the Premier League itself, because if you take a look at the value of the Premier League TV rights, why are they so much higher than those of La Liga, the Bundesliga, Serie A, Ligue 1? Well, it's because in the Premier League, there's greater uncertainty. We know that there's at least a 50-50 chance of, in fact, probably far higher, of Bayern Munich winning the Bundesliga, of Paris Saint-Germain winning the French Ligue 1, of Juventus winning La Liga. And from the perspective of viewers, even if they support those clubs, it does get a bit boring. Whereas in the Premier League, you can genuinely say at the start of each season, well, it could be Chelsea's year, it could be City's year, yeah, United have recruited, Liverpool are doing well, and that extra degree of excitement. Of course, we've had the fantastic achievement of Leicester City, which I think is one of the greatest achievements in terms of the last decade, in overturning the possibilities and probabilities, which has restored an element of romance to the game, and that's actually helped to drive it into more viewers. Everybody's a winner as far as the game is concerned.
Yeah, and you've also seen with this excitement, tapping into the Asian fan base, into a larger global fan base, which again leads into what you were saying earlier, the value of the English Premier League TV rights. Everyone seems to be vying for them. And every year you just see it go up further and further as more people bid for it. But what we've seen, Kieran, over the last year since the pandemic started is, well, the clubs have been hit quite hard. And the latest edition of Deloitte's Football Money League, they revealed that the top 20 clubs in Europe saw their combined revenue drop by 12% in the previous season. And this was the end of the previous season at the start of last year. And that was because of the pandemic. We'll only know the 2020-21 season next year when they release their next report. But Deloitte expects the Premier League to be the hardest hit, estimating financial losses at nearly 1.6 billion euros. That's twice as high as any of Europe's other major leagues. From your perspective, how concerning is the financial impact from the pandemic to Europe's biggest clubs?
Provided the clubs have either a rich benefactor who is prepared to underwrite those losses, or have a business model which is actually giving them a strong balance sheet able to withstand shocks, I don't think the biggest clubs should be in too much of a concern. But then we have to analyse those clubs themselves. If you take a look at the balance sheets of especially the Spanish clubs, which are built on a membership model, Real Madrid have committed hundreds of millions of euros to the expansion of the stadium, which, when it is built, will look absolutely amazing. But at a time when they need cash, and their stadium is a fantastic cash machine, because not only do you have fans turning up on match days, but if you go there during the week, they've got the museum, they can do the tours, there's the hospitality, there's catering, there's lots of facilities there. And what clubs such as Real Madrid and Barcelona have done historically has turned an industry where perhaps you're only earning money 25 to 30 days a year when you've got a home fixtures, you've now got a steady drip of money coming in every day. The pandemic stopped all that. And unlike many other industries which have been hit, ultimately the football is part of the hospitality sector. So therefore it's vying with cinema, with theatre, with clubs, with restaurants, with hotels, with airlines. All of those industries have been hit as well. But they've been able to lay off staff. They've been able to take advantage of government schemes. What I think is unique about the football industry is that it's carried on in the vast majority of cases. And it's got a very, very high cost base in the form of players' wages. Now, if football is continuing to be played, then the players are continuing to be paid. So you've got a lot of money going out, and there's been substantial drops in the money coming in. But if you take a look at a club such as Manchester United, yes, it has been hit significantly. There's no doubt about that. But here, Manchester United's historic ability to build up its commercial links so that it brings in around about 330 million euro a year in commercial deals, those deals have been maintained. The TV money has been maintained probably to the tune of around about 90%, and therefore that it's managed to survive. Yes, they've taken out short-term borrowing facilities, but it's not stopped the big clubs from surviving.
I've been speaking with Kieran Maguire, football financial analyst and professor of football financial analysis at the University of Liverpool, and you've been listening to The Breakfast Grill. Keep it here to BFM 89.9.
You are listening to The BFM Breakfast Grill, brought to you by U Mobile.
Welcome back to The Breakfast Grill. I'm Roshan Kanisan. This morning, I'm speaking with Kieran Maguire, football financial analyst and professor of football financial analysis at the University of Liverpool. Kieran, smaller clubs who have been disproportionately impacted by the pandemic because of their high reliance on match day sales, whether merchandising or on premise or ticket sales being most important. If you take a look at, for example, a comparison here, Chelsea saw match day revenue of 66 million in the year ending 2019, but broadcast money was £200 million. You've got Championship side Bristol had matchday revenue of £6 million, broadcast revenue of £8 million, which is, I mean, it's a significant proportion of their business. So this automatically leads me to a kind of situation where it feels like we're going to see more financially distressed clubs coming into play. Does this mean we could see a new influx or an acceleration of influx of clubs getting taken over, whether by local or foreign investors?
Well, there's no doubt that the pandemic has hit smaller clubs on a proportionate basis to a far greater extent than the likes of the Premier League bigwigs. But many of the smaller clubs have rich owners, because if you don't have any money, then the last thing I'd ever advise you to do is to buy a football club. It's a license to lose money, even in good financial circumstances. And what those owners have done is many of them have dug deeper. There have been some sales of clubs. There have been some clubs that have gone into positions of financial distress here in the UK. But we've, you know, amazingly, that you listen to all of the talk of doom and gloom, it hasn't resonated. Clubs have taken advantage also of government schemes, which have allowed them to pay staff wages through the government rather than through employment. The government's introduced delays in terms of taxation payments. So what that's done is it's pushed the problem down the road. Now, how far it's going to keep kicking that particular can, we're not sure. But whilst those transactions are in place, then there is an element of survival. And also that the Premier League has given to the smaller clubs in the two bottom divisions of English football, they've given them a rescue package, which is worth somewhere in the region of 60 million euro, which has helped them to survive. And for the clubs in the second tier, the English the English Championship, again, the Premier League has offered to help them to pay their tax bills via a loan scheme. So there has been assistance coming from both central government and the Premier League itself to the smaller clubs. Is that enough? Well, if you ask, if I say to you, Roshan, would you rather have $100 or $200 from me? You're going to say $200. So everybody said, yeah, that's great, but we want more. Yeah, that's human nature. But we've managed to survive this season. Everybody is hoping that there will be a return to full crowds, but it's uncertain. It looks as if we speak that the UK government is going to delay the full opening of the economy as a result of the Delta variant of COVID for at least another 2 weeks. Mm-hmm. So I think we have to be cautious. We're not going to go from zero to 100 in terms of the capacity of crowds, but it will be a step forwards. And also we have seen clubs themselves start to address, which is actually their critical problem, which is an inability to control costs. If you or I went to our boss at work and said we'd like a 30% pay rise, when they'd finished laughing, they'd then say no and ask us to leave the room. If you're a footballer, historically, the club says, well, perhaps. And the inability of football club owners to say no to increasing demands from money is the reason why we have the problem that it is. The football's income since the creation of the Premier League has been stratospheric. It's gone up by 2,800%. The problem is, during the same period, the wage bill has gone up by 3,100%. So, you know, you don't have to be an economic genius to realise We could have been a little bit less generous with the players. They won't miss the money in the Premier League. It would simply be a case that yes, you're still going to be incredibly wealthy. Yes, you're still never going to have to work again once you retire. But there is greed in football from all concerned. And it could be argued that some of the new competitors in the Premier League have fueled that, because I did an analysis recently of the profitability of clubs in the Premier League since it started in 1992. And it won't come as a great surprise to learn that Chelsea and Manchester City have lost the most money in the history of the Premier League. Between them, we are talking around about $1 billion. Who was it 10 days ago that was in the final of the Champions League itself? It was Chelsea versus Manchester City.
Yep.
The model works. Throwing money at football generates trophies.
Kieran, let's move over to the European Super League. Now, the football world recently came into an uproar when some of the biggest clubs proposed this ESL that would see the biggest European clubs, including Real Madrid, Manchester United, create a closed cross-border league of their own. Was the significant pushback from the footballing community at large justified or an overreaction?
I think it is justified. There is a belief that when you play football, that if you are good, you will get the rewards. Now, the proposals of the Super League clubs was that you don't have to win football matches in order to qualify for our competition. And, we've all grown up with the World Cup. If your country does well in the qualifiers, it gets to the World Cup finals, and that's a reward for achievement. What some of these clubs wanted to do was to take away the possibility of not qualifying for the competition for the year. And also, at present, the money the money generated by the Champions League is split between 32 clubs. What the Super League club said, well, we don't want to share money with all these other people. Let's make it more closed, and we're going to share it with the 15 founder members. They only managed to find 12, and they represented three countries and seven cities. So it wasn't a European Super League. It was a very, very, very concentrated competition. And I think the view of all football fans that you spoke to, certainly domestically in the UK, and that I think the reaction of fans in England and Germany was substantially different to that of Spain. In Spain, they were far more relaxed about it. They liked the idea of Real Madrid having more money. But the reaction of the fans in England was Leicester City qualified for the Champions League in 2017 because they won the Premier League in 2016, and therefore they deserved some form of reward. And fans just felt that this was a step too far. There was no support for it from players, from managers, from administrators domestically. It was 12 very, very rich men who wanted to keep more money for themselves, and somehow they claimed that they were saving football in doing so. And they didn't quite explain how. Me giving me more money isn't going to help you. Drip feed economics simply doesn't work in practice. It was an idea conceived out of greed. The changes to the UEFA Champions League, which they had agreed from 2024-25, gave these clubs probably around about 85% of what they were looking for. And then they said, 85% isn't enough. We want 100%, and therefore we're going to abandon UEFA.
So with that in mind, Kieran, the ESL really does look to be the biggest symbol of the rising Americanization of football. It's no coincidence that of the 12 permanent members, six of them were from the English Premier League, and a majority of them had American owners. So while the ESL seems to be dead in the water for now, do you think this attempt was more of a warning shot by the big clubs to maybe negotiate better revenue distribution deals?
Well, they've already got the better revenue distribution deals. It was changed in the Premier League in 2018. UEFA have introduced 5- and 10-year coefficients, which means that if one of these clubs doesn't qualify or doesn't make very much progress in the Champions League, it still gets money. So everything has been a case of the threat of Super League has been used as a negotiation tool for many years. And now they've actually used that their one card. I don't think they'll be able to get much more money. There is now talk about the additional places in the Champions League from 2024 being given to clubs who have won their domestic trophies, which I think is great, as opposed to potentially, under the proposals that we have at present, you could finish 7th in the Premier League and 24th in the Super League group games and still win the Champions League. To me, that doesn't say champion. I don't know about you.
It's definitely something to be questioned for sure, Kieran. But the influence of American owners doesn't look to be going anywhere, right? Stan Kroenke has declined buyout offers for Arsenal from Spotify co-founder and CEO Daniel Ek. The Glazers have had over a decade of fan scrutiny now, and they're more than happy taking their ownership and dividends from Manchester United. A Liverpool owner, Fenway Sports Group, reportedly rejected a £3 billion takeover offer just a few months ago, albeit this was before the ESL came about. So do you think we'll see the ESL come back, but in a different form? Or do the clubs just have simply too much to lose or risk at this point?
I think it will be a very significant change if it does come back. Do they want to have a tournament where they keep all the money? Yes, it is. But from a public relations perspective, they really messed up with Super League. It was classic arrogance of the super rich. They just assume that they click their fingers and they get what they want. And remember, we've still got three clubs in Super League. Real Madrid, Barcelona and Juventus are there. But I think it will be very difficult for them to persuade German clubs because of the 50+1 deal, 50+1 ownership models that they have there. And B, in terms of the Premier League, the club owners have come out of this with reputations which have been destroyed. And I think they need to work on that. So in 10 years' time, we could be having this conversation about the Super League. But I don't think we'll be seeing anything for the next few years.
All right. On that note, Kieran, thank you so much for your time this morning.
Thank you.
I've been speaking with Kieran Maguire, football financial analyst, author of The Price of Football and professor of football financial analysis at the University of Liverpool. And you've been listening to The Breakfast Grill. I'm Roshan Kinnison for BFM 89.9.
The Breakfast Grill is brought to you by U-Mobile, unleashing unlimited potential every day.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.